First case for oral argument this morning is J. Link Appellant versus LSI, Inc. and others, affilies. For the appellant, J. Link, we have John Son, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. Brian Keenan, is that right? Okay. Who is from Milwaukee. Welcome. And for the appellee, LSI, we have Mr. Brian Norton from Chicago. Welcome. And also Mr. Andy Nordahl, welcome. And then we also have Mr. Tim Shattuck, an attorney from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Son, you'll be presenting this morning for your client, is that correct?
Correct.
All right, and then Mr. Norton, you'll be presenting for your client. All right, very well. Mr. Son, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Very good, thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Question before the court this morning is the meaning of fair value within SDCL 471A 1434.4. We believe it's important not only in this case to define that fair value, but it's important to add certainty for persons involved in similar circumstances in the future, which hopefully will lead to those parties being able to avoid litigation. In First Western Bank of Wall versus Olson, this court said that fair market value does not mean the same as fair value. If the legislature had intended for it to be fair market value, the legislators would have used fair market value. They did not. They used fair value. And in determining fair value in that First Western Bank of Wall case, the court said you do not look at the discounts that would be applicable to a hypothetical sale to a hypothetical third party. Because in this case, in that particular case and in this one, you have an actual buyer. You have the corporation gaining control of those shares. You don't look at the discounts that would be applicable to a hypothetical third-party buyer. You look at the economic realities of the situations, and as a result, you do not apply those discounts that might apply to a situation where you're selling to a third-party buyer. I think it'd be helpful just to start out first with what the standard that we assert is applicable here on appeal. We think that this issue is de novo. We think that because it's an issue arising out of a statutory interpretation, it's the application of a legal standard to an established set of facts, and embodies questions, mixed questions of law and fact.
But aren't there credibility issues as far as the appraisers?
Your Honor, I think that would go to the mixture of question of laws and facts. It's also a statutory interpretation question and a conclusion of law made by Judge Erickson, which I believe this court has said would be a de novo review.
But, I mean, we've always given deference to the trial court because he had the ability to hear the appraisers testify in front of him, could actually ask him questions if he wanted.
Understand.
We're just got a transcript here.
I'm sorry. I certainly did not mean to interrupt you.
That's
I apologize
fine.
For that. Certainly understand that would be a factual discretion that would be given to the judge, but we think when you're looking at the statutory interpretation and how the court interpreted the statute and applied it to the facts, to an unquestionable facts in here, that this court has held that that's a de novo review.
So you're saying basically that because he misinterpreted the law, you really never get to the credibility of the appraisers.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
You know, Mr. Stone, though, it looked to me like Judge Erickson did not misinterpret the law. It looked to me like he intended to not apply discounts here. And that what we've got is really a factual question about the methodology of the Wisconsin appraisals. Are those discounts in there or not? Isn't that... I mean, didn't Judge Erickson try to eliminate the discounts? He said that.
That's a great question, Your Honor, and I'm glad that you asked that. Judge Erickson did come out and specifically say he's not going to apply a lack of marketability discount in this particular case. He said that fair market or fair value means you don't apply a discount. So he did not apply a lack of marketability. He did not apply a discount for lack of control. But the undisputed testimony is that the figure arrived at by the neutral appraiser here of $16.55 million, as opposed to his initial figure of $21 million, included a discount based upon what would be applicable to a third-party buyer, a hypothetical third-party buyer. And so we're working off the same foundation here as we go forward. It's important to understand that appraisal process in that there were three appraisers. The parties agreed to this non-binding appraisal process. Three appraisers. LSI had one, J. Link had one, and then there's this neutral. their task was to come out with an evaluation as to the value of the corporations, the fair market value of the corporations. The neutral came out initially saying that Jay's shares were worth $21 million. The process that the parties had agreed to also required these appraisers to get together and come to a majority decision as to the value. That required give and take, getting together, discussing this, a give and take. And as part of that process, the neutral appraiser agreed to reduce his valuation from $21 million to $16.55 million based upon a discount that would be applicable to a hypothetical third-party buyer that wasn't applicable to LSI. And that discount was based upon customer concentration. Because LSI had one customer primarily, which was Link Snacks, the appraiser said that if this was to be sold to a third party, the third party would consider that a risk and would require a discount.
Okay, but you know, it looks to me like that risk or factor is different than marketability or lack of control. It looks to me like this is a third variable to determining fair value when you only have one customer.
Your Honor, I think it does not fall within the definition of lack of control. It would not be the lack of marketability that was addressed in First Western Bank of Wall. I think it's an offshoot of the marketability issue. But the point is, it's a discount applied based upon a hypothetical third-party transaction. And what Wall said, the Bank of Wall said, was that's not the economic reality of the situation. That's not what we're looking at. We look at the fact that the corporation is actually taking control or purchasing these shares, and therefore we don't take into account that hypothetical third-party transaction.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand your position then, on fair market value. You're saying that the only problem is this single customer issue, that discount. You're not asserting that somehow the figure, the 16.55, somehow accidentally includes discounts for lack of control or marketability. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The discount that we object to and we ask you to reverse on appeal here is the discount that was applied for the risk of customer concentration. And again, our argument on that is that that is a risk applicable to a third-party hypothetical transaction that's not applicable in this particular case because the corporation's acquiring it. And the First Western Bank of Wall versus Olson case addressed that situation and said that you look at the economic realities.
Is this then kind of a totality of the circumstances or maybe even an equity decision, if you will, by the trial court, because every situation is different, rather than a checklist saying, well, you can't consider this discount or that he makes more of an equitable decision?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. I think the evidence is clear and everybody agrees that the discount from $21 million to $16.55 million was based upon this discount of the risk of customer concentration. And so it's not an equitable issue. It's a legal issue addressed in that First Bank, Western Bank of Wall case where, again, the trial court was looking at this as if it was a hypothetical transaction to a hypothetical third party, and that Olson case says you don't pay attention to that or you take into account the economic realities of the situation. And it also gets, Your Honor, your question is a good one because it gets to the certainty issue of this, the purpose of these statutes, the purpose of using fair value as opposed to fair market value, and that's to avoid a windfall to the purchasing corporation and to add certainty that in situations like this, in the future, you aren't going to be applying different discounts based upon different circumstances, that type of thing. There's some certainty here. You look at it, and you come up with a fair value without applying those discounts.
With certainty, don't you get arbitrariness and possibly unfair results? I mean, it's great if you're probably the lawyer and you've got your checklist, but the person that's actually got the money on the line and that's a partial owner of the corporation, don't they just want a fair shake?
I would respectfully assert, Your Honor, that the certainty avoids those arbitrary decisions. It gives the trial court guidance and gives the parties guidance as to what the outcome is going to be on this, and you won't get into these fights on what's equitable, who is the wrongdoer, who did what wrongdoing, how do you measure those differences between them, and add some certainty that I think helps avoid that arbitrariness.
Let me interrupt you there because It seems to me that the comments to the statute suggest the opposite conclusion, that you do look at who's the wrongdoer and what was the purpose for the dissolution and that type of thing. So, the comments, you guys both discussed them in your briefs, they look to me like it requires somewhat of an equitable view of the situation.
That again, is a good question, Justice Zinter, and I'm glad that you asked it because, of course, the court can look to the comments for guidance, but the comments weren't adopted as part of the statutes. You look at the statutes and you look at what the legislators meant.
I can't buy that. I mean, we look at the UCC comments. We rely heavily on that to interpret what it means. And, you know, fair market value is not defined, or fair value is not defined, so where else are we going to go?
Actually, it is defined within the statutes, and to think that, to get to the point where you would have discounts and arbitrariness or take into difference equities, you would have to assume that the legislators meant something different in the term fair value in Part 13 of the Act versus fair value just a few pages later in Part 14. In Part 13, they're very clear the definition of fair value does not include those discounts. And that's the term they use, fair value. When you turn to Subpart 14, they use that exact same term, the very next section, just a few pages later, and there certainly isn't a different definition of fair value included in that Subpart 14. So if you look at the term used by the legislators, it means the same. It also fulfills the purpose of this situation. That's to avoid a windfall to the purchasing corporation or to encourage the corporation to act wrongfully to try and squeeze down the price that's going to be paid to the shareholder that is having their shares purchased. So I think the legislator's intent in using that term the same way supports that it means the same, and also the purpose of the statutes support the same definition.
So what are you seeking here? Assuming we buy your argument that the trial court erred, do we send it back for a new trial, or do we simply accept the appraisal that you offered? Where do you want us to go?
Thank you, Your Honor. We think that the court has the right to enter judgment for the $21 million for the fair value of these shares. If the court is not comfortable doing that, we'd ask it to be remanded back to the court, the trial court, to apply the statute, the fair value, without taking into account the discount that would be that a third-party hypothetical transaction would involve.
But your valuation, was your valuation submitted on that basis? Was your $21 million expert, so to speak, was that based on the everything else being equal, just eliminating that one discount?
That was the testimony of our appraiser, Your Honor, that was the reason he agreed to discount it from $21 million to $16.55 million. It was based upon that risk of customer concentration.
Well, I guess let me ask it this way. It looked to me like the circuit court rejected your appraisal figure for some other reasons, unrelated to the discount, cattle prices and something else. I forget what it is right now.
And that was the appraiser that Jay Link had selected. The court rejected that, but what we're asking the court to do is accept the neutral appraiser's figure, absent that discount, which would be $21 million for Jay's 50% share. Happy to visit other questions on this. Otherwise, if you'd like, we can turn to some of the other issues that we've raised on appeal. We have two issues that on appeal that really are interrelated, and that would be whether purchasing the shares over time, over a five-year period, is appropriate, and if so, whether there should have been some security applied for this. We think that the statute has a presumption that the purchase price will be paid in cash. Judge Erickson interpreted that statute as not having a presumption that it should be paid in cash. We believe that because 1434.6 mandates that the purchase shall be made within 10 days of the court's order, and 1434.4 says that payments and installments can be ordered by the court if necessary in the interests of equity. That phrase in there about if necessary must mean something. If we don't assume there's ever surplus in the statutes, and the legislature included that language about if necessary. If they didn't think, if that didn't create a presumption, they could have just left that phrase out of it. And again, we think this is a statutory interpretation that would be reviewed de novo. As far as the purchase price in cash, what LSI relied upon for a $16 million purchase price over 5 years, what they relied upon was an affidavit, a three-page affidavit of John Hermeyer that they submitted. The trial court initially said that this affidavit was hearsay, all of it, and would not be considered. And then in the findings of fact and conclusions of law proposed by LSI, they included that it only referred to some banking statements that were in here, but the other parts were not hearsay. We assert the entire affidavit is hearsay, but even if the court considers that, this is the extent of what they presented to the judge to prove, if necessary, the installments had to be paid over time. It doesn't say how much cash LSI had on hand that was available to pay the purchase price. It includes a cash flow analysis from 2003 to 2008, whereas this decision was being made at the end of 2009. So we don't have the last year of financial information. And in fact, we had asked for that financial information as part of this case. LSI went to the court and got a protective order saying that we couldn't get that. So on one hand, they're using it as a shield over here to keep us from getting this financial information. Then when it comes time to decide whether to purchase in cash, they use it as a sword and bring out the 2008 financial information. If you look at this, it also shows, their own figures show, that LSI had free cash flow of $18 million during the time period that this case has been pending. Money that they could have been setting aside to use to purchase this particular corporation in cash. There's no explanation of where that $18 million went, but from their own figures, they had $18 million of cash flow available during the time this was pending. It also, when you're looking at the equities of this particular situation, all of the appraisers agree that as of May 2008, Jay's 50% share in LSI was worth $38 million. Now, whether LSI has to pay $16.55 million or $21 million for that, everybody agrees that as of May 2008, it was worth $38 million. So as you look into the equities of the situation, they're paying a lot less than what they're getting, regardless of whether it's in cash in this particular situation. The other thing on that cash analysis, what it doesn't discuss is LSI's cash flow is directly dependent upon Link Snacks. They're controlled by the same people. Link Snacks decides how much cash flow LSI has by setting the pricing terms with LSI. And so we believe that the affidavit is hearsay and LSI has not met their presumption that the payment should be made, that it was necessary to pay these over 5 years. But that takes us to the second issue on this. Okay, if LSI is in such poor cash position that they have to have 5 years to pay for this, then it only makes sense that Jay should have some type of security to secure these payments over 5 years.
Now, in the first argument, you rejected an equity consideration saying it's black-letter law. The second argument, you again say it's black-letter law, that there's a presumption that there should be one payment in full. Now you're arguing equity all of a sudden.
If the court goes to equity and looks at equity, then what we're looking at is the two go hand in hand. If they're cash poor and need 5 years to pay, then certainly Jay should have some type of security for those payments. What the court ordered is...
What was the court's reasoning, trial court's reasoning for denying security? Did it give one?
It did not give one, Your Honor, and that's a good question because it wasn't briefed, wasn't argued to the court, it wasn't in the court's October written decision, wasn't addressed in that. The first time it came up is when LSI submitted proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law to the court, which the court adopted in their entirety except for a handwritten change as to the date of the closing that the issue of no security was addressed. So we don't know why the court did not give security in this particular situation, but it's our no lender, the court did order that Jay completely turn over ownership of his shares to LSI and become an unsecured creditor for that five-year period. No lender is going to loan $16.55 million to a company, and that doesn't even take into account the relationship between LSI and Jay, which has been very poor over the years. A bank wouldn't do it in a typical situation. But now Jay's expected to believe that LSI is going to act in his best interest and make these payments without any type of security. So, and then the very last issue, Your Honor, is the dismissal of the breach of fiduciary duty claims against Smith and Walls. And very quickly, in the Jay's initial complaint, he brought a tort claim against them for breach of fiduciary duty. There was not a pending motion to dismiss. There was not a pending summary judgment motion on that particular issue. But the judge dismissed those claims without findings of fact and conclusions of law, which by itself we believe is reversible error. And again, it was a situation where it wasn't addressed in any of his written opinions, and that dismissal of those claims was simply included in the findings of fact and conclusions of law that LSI submitted to the court and that the court adopted.
So what rationale did he adopt in the findings and the conclusions? Why did he dismiss it?
There was none, Your Honor. That wasn't addressed in the findings or the conclusions. It was simply in the final order that simply said these claims are dismissed.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Norton, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I thank you for the privilege of being able to argue here today before you. May it please the court. There are four broad points I'd like to make before I get into details in response to the argument you made. Number one, this is not a dissenters' rights case. This is a case in which Jay Link sought to dissolve an active and vibrant corporation that employed some 650 people. The court found that there was no probable grounds for dissolving that corporation, that Jay had consistently tried to destroy LSI. In Wisconsin, the jury found that Jay had breached fiduciary duties to LSI both before and after he left, either maliciously or in intentional disregard of LSI's rights. Number two, the court, under the circumstances case, could have applied discounts. It did not have to apply Olson in this case, but the court, in fact, adopted Olson, and there are no discounts applied to Jay's value of his shares in this case. The court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the fair value of 50% interest in LSI as a going concern was $16,550,000. There is no discount in the value of Jay's shares in the court's decision. Number three.
But there is in the appraiser's methodology.
Your Honor, there's no discount. This is the first time I've ever characterized what they describe, what the appraiser is, a discount. If you took that approach, every risk factor a corporation faces in valuation would be considered a discount. He's just trying to characterize the discount to try to squeeze it into Olson. But the question in Olson really is, did the court discount Jay's shares? It did not discount Jay's shares. When it looked at the corporation as a whole, the court concluded that that corporation wasn't worth the same that a corporation would be worth that had multiple customers. Perhaps we should go into that point, Your Honor. In the Olson case, the court was concerned about discounts to the minority shareholders' value of shares. In this case, the way the valuation came down is, as Mr. Song described, there were three appraisers in Wisconsin. There was a neutral, and there were two-party appraisers. They all got together to come up with a preliminary conclusion as to value, and then had to get together and decide amongst those values what the proper value was. They had to test each other as to, okay, what assumptions did you make? Did you make the right assumptions? Can we test each other in terms of what the true fair value of Jay's shares are in the company? The neutral appraiser originally calculated that the value of LSI was $42 million, meaning that a proportionate value of Jay's shares was 50% would be $21 million. It did so based on a model that looked at other corporations of similar size, similar revenue, similar profitability, those natures. And it came to the conclusion it was $21 million in its preliminary conclusion. When it got together with the other two appraisers, our appraiser pointed out that the corporations that they used in their comparative model did not have the customer concentration problem that LSI did. They had multiple customers, and a corporation that has one customer is not as valuable to a corporation that has multiple customers. That's a value of the corporation as a whole, not Jay's shares. That's true of the corporation as a whole. It's simply not as valuable as a corporation has multiple customers. That's all the neutral recognized. The neutral recognized that, looked and said, you know, that's a valid point. We did value based on comparables that have multiple customers. Therefore, we're going to reduce our value. We agreed $16,550 is the proper fair value for Jay shares without discounts.
Was there any evidence in the record that, I hate to use the word parent corporation, but that there might be a loss of that sole customer base? Is there any evidence to support that, or is that just theoretical?
Well, there's two answers there. First of all, you start from the proposition But the court did find that Jay Link repeatedly tried to destroy LSI. And in the record, there was evidence in the Wisconsin proceeding that came into this case that Jay Link had threatened the supply of jerky to Link Snacks by suggesting, hey, I control LSI, I'm not going to give you your jerky. So that's a concern that Link Snacks had with respect to LSI, and Jay repeatedly tried to destroy the relationship. The second part of it, though, is it's not simply a function. As Mr. Song suggests, that, gee, there's a relationship between Link Snacks and LSI, there's a danger that relationship will go away. The danger when you have a single customer is not only that that customer can pull its business away, but that customer is subject to all the vagaries in the market. That customer's plant burns down, or its sales staff disappears. You're subject to all the vagaries of the parent company, if you will. So the risk is not simply that the parent company will say, I'm not going to buy from you anymore. You're subject to all of their risk of doing business in general. And that's the concern why you say a corporation only having one customer simply is a corporation that doesn't have the same value as a company that has multiple customers. And that's all they recognize. They didn't discount Jay's shares. They said the corporation as a whole, as a going concern, is not worth as much as a corporation that has multiple customers. And that, by the way, Your Honor, is not an abuse of discretion. Mr. Song talked about the standard in this case. While it's certainly true that the standard to be applied is a de novo review, once the standard is established and the court applies the standard, it's an abuse of discretion standard. And the standard articulated in the Herbold case is the trial court need not be exact in determining values, but rather it need only be within a plausible range. The values it came up with are within a plausible range of the values. The only values determined by the neutral and our appraiser is $16,550. That's the number they both agreed upon. The court found that Jay's expert was incredible. At the same time they were saying the value was $16,550, he was saying the value of Jay's shares was $70 million. So for that reason, Your Honor, we think that the whole notion that somehow there's a discount baked into this thing is wrong. The judge did not apply discounts. He was abundantly clear in his decision. He rejected the idea of my lack of marketability discount. He rejected a minority discount.
If I understand your arguments correctly, though, even though you're talking about ranges and that, between the two of you, you're presenting to the court, if you get to the valuation issue, we have two figures to pick from, your figure or their figure, correct? There's no third figure or other choices out there.
Correct, Your Honor. The only number was $16,550. And by the way, the $21 million number, that's the other number you're referring to that you
yes.
picked. That number was a preliminary number of the neutral appraiser. That was not his final number. So you'd be picking a preliminary number of the appraiser. He came back. The final number that they agreed upon was $16,550. After he analyzed the issue, listened to the other appraisers, and considered all the evidence, the neutral came back and said $16,550 is the right number. And that's what they signed on to. I can back up one step from a legal point of view and address the question that was raised earlier, and that is, this all assumed, by the way, that the proper value or the proper valuation method is fair value. That applies the Olson case. While the court applied no discounts, in our view, he certainly could have applied discounts if he wanted to. We don't believe that the Olson case should be extended to a case like this for a dissolution and a buyout under the dissolution statute. And the reason for that is the comments that are made in the official comments to the Model Business Corporation Act. They make clear that those two claims, those two causes of action, are not clearly analogous. And the reason they're not clearly analogous is because in the context of a shareholder dissent case, a shareholder is being forced out. He doesn't want to give up his shares, but he's being forced out of the corporation. In that context, the court has said, look, you get fair value, no discounts. That's not the context of this case. This case, Jay Link sought to dissolve Link Snacks. He wanted to liquidate the company and get the liquidation value for the company in exchange for stock. That's what he tried to do.
So you're basically arguing to us that the court should interpret the statute to allow an equity decision rather than Mr. Son's checklist.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that's what the Model Business Corporation Act suggests. It says in a circumstance like this, you have to look at all the facts and circumstances. And those facts and circumstances include the fact that Jay Link repeatedly tried to destroy LSI, he breached fiduciary duties to LSI, and you ask yourself the question, and there's no probable grounds for a dissolution. So you ask yourself the question, why should a shareholder who has no probable grounds to dissolve a corporation and who tried to destroy the corporation get more than he would have got if he sold his shares on the open market? Why should he get a bonus? That would only encourage, by the way, people filing dissolution claims in the hope that they could at least get fair value because they said, well, maybe I'll win, I'll take fair value. It seems to me that that's wrong, which is why the Model Business Corporation Act says you look to all the facts and circumstances before to determine the value. So in this case, the court could apply discounts, but the fact is it did not.
What about,
we haven't appealed that, by the way. Sorry.
What about the fact that the Wisconsin jury found breaches of fiduciary duty on both sides?
The Wisconsin jury found that Jack and Troy breached fiduciary duties. It awarded no damages against Troy and $736,000 in actual damages against Jack. But the court made clear in this case that there was no indication that Jack or Troy breached fiduciary duties as directors in LSI. And that's the key. The court found that in this case with no evidence to suggest that whatever they did was a breach of the fiduciary duties to Jay Link as a director in LSI. In contrast, the jury in Wisconsin specifically found that Jay Link breached his fiduciary duties to LSI and did so maliciously or in intentional disregard of LSI's rights. So I see a difference. Also, as the court noted, the trial court in Wisconsin found that Jack's conduct paled in comparison to Jay's. And that, by the way, maybe perhaps dovetails into another argument Mr. Song had raised, and that has to do with res judicata. Because there are two other directors in Wisconsin who were tried for breach of fiduciary duty who were directors of South Dakota. That was Larry Jarvelin and John Hermeyer. Both were officers of Ellis Link Snacks and officers of South Dakota. Jay says that res judicata should not apply in this case because there's no mutuality of the parties. It's not the exact same parties in Wisconsin as there was in South Dakota. That sets back South Dakota jurisprudence by about 25 years and rejects the Black Hills case, which said that defensive res judicata applies in this case and rejected the idea of mutuality in the case.
So you're saying that the Wisconsin long-arm statute could have brought in the South Dakota directors and they could have been joined in the Wisconsin litigation?
They certainly could have, and we've indicated our briefs. I also think, Your Honor, whether they could have been brought in or not, the fact is he litigated the claim in Wisconsin. If you look at the complaints and put them side by side, the exact cause of action in Wisconsin and South Dakota, they're identical. There's no difference between two. Indeed, that's why the trial court in this case stayed the action originally, because the two causes of action are inextricably interrelated.
Well, but the circuit court didn't really give us any reasons why he dismissed those claims, did he?
His decision does not indicate it, but I would argue, Your Honor, that it's based on the statute is why he did it. I mean, the statute itself says 1434.5 that once the order is entered that says you're selling the company, you no longer have any rights or status as a shareholder. The official comments make clear that that means any claim you have as a shareholder is forever lost or barred unless you bring it as part of the valuation case. That's what the comment suggests. And the comment, the clear intent, I believe, of the comments is a clean break. You don't want a situation where a corporation buys out a dissenting shareholder who's been a thorn in the side of the corporation, and yet nonetheless can still proceed to sue the officers and directors for claims of breach of fiduciary duty. The point of the statute is a clean break. You buy them out. The company gets to move along to save the jobs, save the corporation, allow it to go as a going concern. And so in this case, Jay didn't make one peep about the breach of fiduciary duty claims during the valuation case. Didn't raise it at all during the valuation case. Came to the conclusion of the case, the order was entered, he didn't raise the issue and bring it up. So I think the answer is, Your Honor, under the statute, by terms of the statute, it's barred by virtue of that language. But in addition, as a legal matter, res judicata and collateral estoppel apply. He tried the claim in South Dakota. Two of the directors that indicated were tried in Wisconsin. The jury found that what they did didn't violate fiduciary duties. No liability for those directors who were also directors of South Dakota. Jay argued all the arguments of what the South Dakota directors did in the Wisconsin action. Terry Smith and Doug Walls, the two South Dakota directors, both testified in Wisconsin. Terry Smith live and Doug Walls by deposition. They were there in the case. He argued that what they did in South Dakota in the board meeting was part of the breach of fiduciary duties. And as to the two officers and directors who were South Dakota directors and also directors of Link Snacks who were parties in Wisconsin, the jury found no liability. He cannot go and argue, you know, sue some defendants and then say, okay, I lost on those two. I'm going to argue, sue a couple of other defendants down the road and simply going seriatim down the list until he finds one perhaps he wins on. That's what the court in Black Hill said we're not going to accept. Defensive collateral estoppel and res judicata prevents a party from doing just that, from basically splitting their claim, which is essentially what he's trying to do.
Can we go to the installment?
Sure.
Do you agree that there has to be a showing of necessity in order to justify allowing installment payments as opposed to a lump sum?
The statute says installment payments can be made in the discretion of the court if necessary.
What necessity did the trial court find here?
In this case, the court had the affidavit of John Hermeyer. They make an issue that somehow the affidavit of John Hermeyer is deficient because of hearsay. I don't see how John Hermeyer's affidavit, the gist of it was, look, here's the cash flow of LSI over the last 5 years. You can tell from the cash flow statements they do not have $16,550,000. How many corporations sit on cash sufficient to buy out a 50% shareholder? A corporation, by definition, uses the cash for the business. So they don't sit on $16,550,000. That's within the documents we gave them. Those documents, by the way, the contention, someone didn't produce them. John Hermeyer's analysis was based on the financial records of LSI that were produced throughout the Wisconsin proceedings. The only reason 09 wasn't there, because the year wasn't over. They didn't have the data when this occurred. They didn't have the 09 data yet. So they had what they had, the five-year data. In that document, it shows the cash flow available to LSI. That cash flow does not support the $16,550,000 payment to J-Link up front. And by the way, let's not forget, this is the man who tried to destroy LSI repeatedly. He'd like nothing better than to get the entire cash up front, which would put a constraint on LSI's ability to do business. The judge recognized from that document that he didn't have the cash flow. So we awarded Jay a payment over 5 years. That payment with 4.5% interest, we know the rates today, what they are for a five-year T-bill, 4.5% interest is not a bad rate for Jay Link. He gets $360,000 a month under that terms, that five-year order. So the evidence in the case clearly supported his contention that a five-year payout based on the available cash flow of LSI so they could continue to do business and not have to close down was five-year payout of $16,550,000, plus, by the way, $3 million in interest, which is subject to our other appeal, which I know we're not arguing today. So it's $19 million over 5 years.
Address the security issue, then. If you don't have enough cash to pay up front, why shouldn't there be security?
Well, Your Honor, the question of whether, first of all, I'll start from the proposition, that the question of whether the court awards security is completely and totally in the court's discretion. And if you look at the facts of this case, you have a situation where, and I don't mean to repeat it, and I know I've said it, but breach of fiduciary duty, which was intentional and malicious, and the court's finding that Jay had repeatedly tried to destroy LSI. Why in the world would you give Jay Link, the man who tried to destroy LSI, a security interest against property? I think, Your Honor, it came down to that, that it's not, at this point in time, the best thing that could happen to the corporation is to have a complete and total break. If Jay Link has a security interest in LSI's assets, he can cause mischief to the corporation. What happens, for example, if we're going to go to get a lending facility from a bank? We need to get a subordination of his indebtedness. Are we going to get a subordination of indebtedness from Jay Link? Are you able to go forward with the business and try to move forward and try to build the business up? I think the judge recognized, and it doesn't say this in here, but certainly it's consistent with his findings, that you don't want to give security interest to a party who has tried to destroy the corporation because it gives them that tie to the corporation, which we're trying to stop and trying to get rid of under the dissolution statute.
What kind of record was made on the nature of this hearsay affidavit? Was the entire affidavit objected to at trial?
That's a good question, Your Honor. The way the affidavit came in, and this was a comment they made in their brief, that somehow they didn't have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Hermeyer on that affidavit, and that's plainly untrue. The way this came down, Your Honor, is that the parties, once the court determined valuation of the corporation as a whole, he set a separate hearing to determine the terms. On August 4th, and you can find it at the settlement record at 475 and 477, the parties entered into a stipulated order. The stipulated order said that the parties will submit their briefs on the question of the terms by August 14th of 2010. On August 14th of 2010, the parties submitted their briefs as to what the terms should be for the buyout. In that submission, we included the affidavit of John Hermeyer. The stipulated order also said if either party would like an evidentiary hearing on the submissions that are made, they had until September 15th of 2010, 1 month later, to ask the court for an evidentiary hearing on anything that was submitted in connection with the terms of the buyout. They never once asked for an evidentiary hearing on what we submitted. They didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing on the Hermeyer affidavit or all that piece of it. So I would argue, Your Honor, they waived it. They had the opportunity to cross if they wanted to. They had the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing. They chose not to.
Was there any request for security or outlined on exactly what they were requesting?
Your Honor, the way that came up, again, I think Mr. Song, it's not exactly how he said it, I don't believe. The parties were both submitted briefs on the 14th saying what the terms should be. We said it should be 5 years with no security. They said it should be a lump sum. They never once asked for security in that context. The only time security came up is once we drafted the order when the court said, look, here's what it's going to be, 5 years. The court didn't mention security at all in the opinion. We said no security because that's what the court's opinion indicated, its original opinion. That's when they said, we object to the order. We think there should be security. So that's the context in which it came up. It was not fully briefed ahead of time.
So there was no evidence offered to the trial court why security was necessary or not necessary? Just legal argument?
Correct, Your Honor.
Surely I have a question.
Hold it. We got a question. Justice Severson's been listening.
Mr. Norton, I have a question on the shares and the security. Have the shares actually been transferred to LSI? I know there was some discussion about them being pledged for another loan. Have they actually been transferred, or can they be transferred?
We'll turn it back down. You want to?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. The answer to that question is no. They have not been transferred to LSI. As you know from our other brief, LSI, when push came to shove, even though Jay demands immediate payment, he was not capable of delivering his shares at the time of the order, at the time of the closing that the court set, because he had pledged them, unbeknownst to anybody else, and we say in violation of the statute, he had pledged the shares to a bank to get a $4 million loan. Your Honor, we still do not have the shares. He has made a motion. He has, I think, now obtained those shares. So he's apparently paid off the bank, and he wants to lodge those with the court, but we have not received them. So the situation is such that even though we have an order in place since December to close this transaction, we still don't have his shares, which goes to my argument why we shouldn't have to pay interest on shares that he couldn't deliver that we never got. But if the answer is no, we do not have the shares.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sine, you have 10 minutes. Turn it down low. I think I'm getting a reverb. Okay. Were you able to hear Justice Severson's question?
Yes, I was, Your Honor. And perhaps that's a good place to start, Justice Severson, is to answer your questions. The answer is yes. Jay does have those shares available to be transferred. We made a motion. They've been released from the security. We have made a motion to the trial court to deposit those shares with the clerk of courts pending this appeal. LSI has objected to that motion, and so we just recently filed a motion to stay the judgment, offering to deposit those shares again with the clerk. So the quick answer to that is yes, they are available to be transferred. Let's go back to talking a little bit about the fair value issue. LSI has spent a considerable amount of time in the trial court and in their briefs, and again this morning, throwing mud against Jay Link. The court, trial court, Judge Erickson, said that neither party came out unscathed in that Wisconsin action. The court said that that information of the conduct of the parties was not relevant to his consideration of determining fair value. The court would not consider that. And as they throw the mud at Jay, they don't want to talk about the breach of fiduciary duties that the Wisconsin action found against their parties. But getting into that mudslinging doesn't answer the questions we have here about fair value. It's irrelevant. It also ignores the fact that they're paying $21 million or $16.55 million for something that everybody agrees is worth at least $38 million and probably has appreciated since May of 2008. But we get back to the fair value question. Mr. Norton said that there wasn't a discount here and that every risk would be then considered a discount. That's not the situation here. What we have is this neutral appraiser specifically saying the reason that he reduced his $21 million to $16.55 million was a discount applicable that would be applicable if this was a third-party transaction. That's not true in this case. Link Snacks is acquiring it. Link Snacks, it's a strength to them, actually.
Isn't it really a matter of semantics whether this is a discount or whether it's one of the multitude of factors an appraiser puts into his appraisal to arrive at his professional opinion?
Your Honor, there are a multitude of factors that go into an opinion. However, this specific issue is only applicable if you're looking at it as a hypothetical transaction to a third-party buyer, which ignores the economic realities. The other things come into play regardless of the situation, who's buying, third party or the corporation. But this is a discount that only applies if you're looking at a third-party transaction as opposed to the economic reality of the situation where Link Snacks or LSI is obtaining control of the shares, and LSI and Link Snacks are controlled by the same people. It's a strength, actually, to Link Snacks, not a discount, that they have this high customer concentration. Troy Link testified that LSI is the lifeblood of Link Snacks. The fact that they now both control both corporations, is actually a strength to them, not a risk, not a discount that should be applied in determining fair value. It also gets into, again, the certainty of the situation. This court providing certainty to future parties that get into this situation. Otherwise, it fulfills the purpose of the statutes. It also avoids these valuation hearings where you should be looking at what the value is, the fair value of a corporation, from becoming a mudslinging trial and extending out with all these other people coming in trying to bring in all these other circumstances that are irrelevant to the actual fair value of the corporation. Should also touch on, and in fact, in our brief, we've cited cases from other courts in which they refuse to apply discounts under these types of statutes and circumstances. Should turn to the res judicata issue and the breach of fiduciary duty. Again, the court did not issue any explanation. First of all, the court didn't even address the dismissal of the breach of fiduciary duties in its written opinion, in its written letter opinion in October of 2009.
Do you concede that those two South Dakota directors could have been sued under the Wisconsin long-arm statute?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know Wisconsin long-arm statute, and I'm sorry, I can't answer that particular question. But they weren't part of Wisconsin action. And the case that would be tried against them is different than the allegations that would be made against the directors in the Wisconsin action. Each person would stand and fall on their own conduct.
So do we need to remand this for findings?
Yes, Your Honor. Remand it so that the breach of fiduciary duty claim can be heard and decided.
Or remand at least for the trial court to enter findings on why it's res judicata.
Correct. At least remand so that we can have that moment before the court to argue our appropriate sides.
What about the comments? It seems like it's my day for comments. But again, we have comments that seem to be very clear that any kind of shareholder action is terminated by the dissolution.
And that's a good question, Your Honor, and I would look at the actual language of 47(1)(a)(1434.5). And what it says is, upon entry of the order to purchase the shares, the court shall dismiss the petition to dissolve the corporation, and the petitioning shareholder no longer has any rights or status as a shareholder of the corporation. That doesn't mean that any past claims are dismissed. That doesn't mean that pending prior actions are no longer applicable. It just means that he's not a shareholder anymore and can't enforce the same rights that a shareholder would have with the corporation. So if you look at the actual statute and the language of the statute, there's nothing in there that says that the prior breach of fiduciary duty claims are automatically dismissed.
But the comments speak in the past tense. And they say all the claims the petitioner may have had in his capacity as a shareholder are dismissed.
Again, Your Honor, the comments, you can look at them for guidance, but I don't think that they override the actual language of the statute. And does that make sense that the court would order a valuation hearing and determine the fair value of the corporation, and that would automatically dismiss a breach of fiduciary duty claim or some other tort claim that a shareholder might have at the time? That's an issue that the shareholder should have the opportunity to be heard. And also in this particular case, Your Honor, if you look at the order, I think it was in May or April of 2009, the court said we're going to have a trial on the valuation of the corporation. It didn't address the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And again, we don't know why Judge Erickson dismissed this, because there's no findings and there's no conclusions.
Of course, then we have a ruling and says if there's any basis to support the trial court's decision, we'll affirm.
There's also the decision, Your Honor, that says that if the court, that findings of fact and conclusions of law are required when a case is dismissed, and if not, it should be remanded.
So procedurally, on the race to the college, was that briefed and argued to the trial court?
No, Your Honor. There's not a pending motion to dismiss. There's not a pending motion for summary judgment. That issue was never briefed to the trial court. First time that it came up was in the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. And it wasn't actually in the findings and conclusions. It was in the final portion of that under the heading of order where the court dismissed those particular claims. There are some questions about the installment payments also. Again, There's no explanation as to why LSI wasn't preparing for this purchase. They knew it was coming. The action was started in 2005. They had all that time between then and 2009 to prepare for the payment. They had $18 million of free cash flow during that period of time, and we still haven't heard where that $18 million went. They talk about the 2009 year-end information wasn't available yet. That's why they didn't produce it.
Did you request an evidentiary hearing on any of that?
We had discovery requests asking for financial information, monthly financial statements, balance sheets, that type of thing. They came in and asked for a protective order, which the court granted on that particular issue. So we were not able to get that information. And certainly, although there may not have been year-end financial statements, there has to be monthly financial statements showing income to date, showing a cash or a balance sheet that would show cash.
Like, though, all that the judge had were the briefs and the accompanying affidavits.
On this issue, yes, Your Honor.
And then there was no request by either side for any further evidentiary hearing other than what you submitted.
That's correct, Your Honor, as far as the affidavit is concerned.
How far are we into the 5 years of installments today?
Well, the order was entered in December of 2009. They have not made any of the payments pending this appeal.
Okay.
So no payments have been
made. So the whole 5 years is yet to commence.
Correct.
All right.
Correct, Your Honor. Just in conclusion again, Your Honor, and I know I've said this, but the discount that the trial court applied for this risk of customer concentration would only be applicable to a hypothetical third-party buyer. And it ignores the economic realities that it's actually LSI that's controlling it. And this risk discount that the neutral appraiser applied is not applicable to this particular situation. Very much appreciate the opportunity to come before you and argue. It's always a pleasure. It's always an honor. And we thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Son. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes and then hear the next case.